You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Tony Greenham, the Director of Economy, Enterprise and Manufacturing here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here for this lunchtime talk. We're going to have a fascinating discussion on banks, and it's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Ellen Brown. Ellen is the founder and president of the Public Banking Institute. This is a non-profit organisation working to achieve the implementation of public banking at all levels of the American economy and government. Ellen combines the forensic, detailed skills of a lawyer, but also the journalistic skills of a writer, and is a powerful advocate for the idea of public banking. And just a word on banking. This is a week in which HSBC have announced that they're happy to stay in London, and for which we should all be eternally grateful, it would seem. Bank stocks over the last couple of weeks have been gyrating down and up. John Vickers, who chaired the government's main investigation into reforming the banks after the crisis, has said that he thinks the reforms have run aground and banks lack sufficient capital. So it would seem that banking is still an issue that has far from gone away as a public policy issue. And yet the other day I was involved in a panel debate here on something called Banking Futures. And on the panel was James Lee Pemberton. Now, he is the chief executive of UK Financial Investments. And they look after the government's our stakes in two banks, Lloyds and RBS. And he used to be my former boss. He's a fantastic guy. I have immense respect for him. We had a chat in the Gerrard Bar afterwards. And it was very clear that, that in his view and the view of the establishment in the UK, the government should under no circumstances be in the business of owning a bank. Now, that has become something of a received wisdom. We don't like received wisdoms at the RSA. We like to challenge and question and find out whether that is indeed the right stance to be taken. So there is absolutely nobody better to help us do that than Ellen Brown, and I will hand over to her to explain to us why we should own the banks. Thank you. Please welcome Ellen.
Thanks, Tony. Okay, the idea that we, the people, should own the banks is not a new idea, and it's not an untested idea. In fact, globally, up until the 1990s, 40% of banks were publicly owned. They were largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which also escaped the credit crisis, at least for the first few years. Of course, now we have a global economy, and it's all the countries have gotten infected, and even China. So today, 25% of banks are globally owned. And the largest banks globally are publicly owned, including the two largest banks in two largest banks by market capitalization, which are in China. The largest bank by deposits, which is Japan Post Bank, they sold off 11% of their stock in November, but they're still majority owned by the government. The largest bank by number of branches, State Bank of India, the largest development bank, which is in China, and the seven safest banks led by KfW, which is the German public development bank. It's also in states with strong public banking sectors that we've seen economic miracles, where they've gone from abject poverty to quite profitable economies, including China, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, post-war Germany and Japan, Brazil, and Argentina. China is the leader. That's this red line that just cuts through everything else. They grew by 10% a year for 30 years, which was unbelievable. They're slipping now, but they're still growing. Last year, they grew 6.9%, so they're still doing remarkably well, and they have a very strong public banking sector. Korea is another economic miracle. According to Ha Jun Cheng, who wrote a book called Bad Samaritans, he's a Korean economist, per capita income increased 14-fold in 40 years, something that took Britain two centuries and the U.S. one and a half centuries to do. And he says in his book is basically all about how it was not actually capitalism that was responsible for this remarkable growth. He attributes it to the fact that the government owned all the banks so it could direct the lifeblood of business, which is credit. So that's the key, it seems to me, why we need banks in the first place and why they should be publicly owned. Today, banks create credit, but they manipulate this for their own ends. And they don't just create credit like issuing loans, they actually create money. So they create the vast majority of the money supply. You can tell that from this chart. The blue line is coins and dollar bills, so that's what's created by the government. Most people think that money's created by the government, so you see the pictures of presidents and kings and queens on the bills, and you figure government created it. But very little of it is actually created by the government, and all the rest, that red line, M2, the circulating money supply, comes from banks when they make loans. Money reformers have been saying that for decades, but the Bank of England just came out, so now it's official if the Bank of England says it. They said in their quarterly report this spring of 2014, contrary to popular belief, banks do not actually lend their deposits. They create money in the form of bank deposits when they make new loans. So what's wrong with this model? First of all, if all money is created as debt, then in order to pay back these loans, all that money has to be repaid into the circulating economy in some way in order for the debts to be repaid. But it isn't. For one thing, more money is always owed back than was issued in the first place. So over the course of a 30-year loan, you're going to owe twice as much as was created in the original loan. There are people who calculate this out and say, well, it's still possible to pay it back if the lenders pay all the money that they get every month back into the system or give it back to the borrowers, but that just doesn't happen. The money is, some people save money, they don't spend it back into the system. It goes into offshore tax havens, it goes into more money-making money schemes. So what you wind up with is debt grows exponentially while the real economy grows linearly, which is an unsustainable situation, that the exponential growth ultimately hits a wall when you run out of borrowers. We went around the world. First we basically exploited the third world, and now we're back at exploiting our own mortgage or homeowners, etc. So when you run out of debtors, then the whole thing collapses. Second of all, the fact that banks, private bankers, have control of who gets the money and on what terms. When you put your money in the bank, legally, it becomes the property of the bank. All you have is an IOU. So they can legally do what they want with this money. We used to have, in the U.S., we had the Glass-Steagall Act, which ever since the 1930s, banks were required to keep their deposits separate from their investing, so they couldn't gamble with your deposits. But under President Clinton, the first President Clinton, I'm going to that, under President Clinton, that it was repealed. And so now they can virtually, they can do their derivatives, they can buy oil, they're buying all sorts of things with our deposits. They can determine who gets loans and on what terms, so they can make loans to their cronies very cheaply, or they can lend to each other at the Fed funds rate, which is currently 0.35%, and then they lend to us at whatever, up to 16 or 18% on credit cards. And they cannot lend at all, which creates booms and busts. And third is risk. They have managed to persuade us that if, under capitalism, of course, if they're a bankrupt bank, they should just go out of business. But if you're a big bank, you get bailed out by the taxpayers. And when governments got tired of bailing them out, or in 2010 in the U.S., we had the Dodd-Frank Act, which supposedly said no more bailouts. But the way they avoided bailouts was with bail-ins. So banks are mandated it's not just legal, but they're actually required to take their creditors' money to recapitalize themselves, which means that the money of the stockholders, the bondholders, and the depositors, the largest class of creditor of any bank. And we saw the effect in Cyprus, which was the first of these bail-ins, but there have been a lot of bail-ins in Europe last year, and more are expected starting in January in the EU. They're actually supposed to take the depositors' money. Theoretically, you're protected by deposit insurance, but you're limited by whatever deposit insurance group you have covering you. In the U.S., we have the FDIC, but it only has $67 billion in it to cover $6.5 trillion in deposits. So some money reformers, you've had presentations here, it's a very popular idea that we should therefore eliminate the ability of banks to create money and give that power solely to the government. But the problem with that is you're then going to eliminate that whole everything between the blue line and the top of the red line, all that money which is created by banks. When those loans get paid off, you have to replace that money in some way. Either you're going to have a radical shrinking of the money supply, or you're going to have a monetary authority that has to issue, in the U.S., it would be like $10 trillion worth of money to fill the gap. And how would you, it'd be very disruptive. It's, you know, kind of a radical change in the system, and it seems just unlikely to happen. But the easier alternative is to continue to allow banks to create money, but make the banks be public utilities owned by the people, acting on behalf of the people in the public interest. This was, it seems to me, the ideal model was in colonial Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's day. For 50 years, they paid no taxes except for an excise tax on liquor. There was no inflation caused by, extra money. There was some prices inflated because of shortages. And there was no government debt. So it was a totally sustainable, perfect money system. That what they did was all the colonies at that time issued paper scrip. But in Pennsylvania, they issued most of it in the form of loans. They had what was called a land bank. So they made loans to the farmers. Say, this is just my hypothetical model, but let's say you started with $105. You could lend $100 at 5% interest, and then you could spend the 5%, the $5 into the economy for your budget, roads and bridges and so forth, and then the whole 105 would come back as principal and interest, and then you could lend 100 again, spend the 5, it all comes back as principal and interest. So the money is out there, so you have a sustainable, you don't have a continual need for growth. In the U.S. today, we have one state-owned depository bank, and that's in North Dakota. And that's actually how I started writing about this, was I knew that was the only state-owned bank. So I was watching North Dakota, and in the fall of 2008 and then into the spring of 2009. So at first there were four states that were still in the black. All the rest had gone in the red. And then there were three, and then there was two, and then there was one, and it was North Dakota. So I just suspected that was the reason and started investigating and writing about it. And then I got so much interest in it that, in the end, we formed an institute to try to promote this idea. It seemed like a good idea. They also have the nation's lowest unemployment rate. They still do, even though oil has crashed the last year and a half. They have one of the lowest foreclosure rates. They have the lowest default rate on student debt, the lowest default rate on credit card debt. The bank itself was set up in 1919. It was not actually a socialist engine. North Dakota is a very conservative Republican state. But what they were trying to do was to keep their money in the state for the benefit of North Dakotans. So it was a sovereignty issue, not a socialism issue. At the time, the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. That it was a cartel, a Rockefeller bank connected to a Rockefeller railroad connected to a Rockefeller granary. And the granary was taking their grain. By the time they sold the grain, they had such high costs for this whole system that they made no profits, and therefore they couldn't pay their mortgages, and they were losing their farms, and they could see that this was unfair. So they set up the bank on the model of all of the state's revenues by law are deposited into the bank, and then they do what all banks do, which is leverage those deposits into loans for state purposes, for public purposes. In the last 10 years, they've returned $40 million annually to the state, so that's for a state of 670,000 people, that's a quite nice return. And they've had an average return on equity of between 17 and 26%. Oops. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal in November of 2014 that said that the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, with two of our most profitable banks. So quite remarkable that Bank of North Dakota had a return on equity of 18.56%, about 70% higher than Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. And this is still, of course, that was November of 2014, and some people say, well, it's all about oil, they've got oil. But first of all, the oil boom did not hit until 2010, if you look at a chart. And second of all, the oil has collapsed since the summer of 2014, and every year in the last 12 years, they've had record profits, like more profits than they had the year before, and they had their highest profits ever reported December 2015. So the bank's profits are not the state's profits. The bank is making profits for another reason, and a reason appears to be that they just have a better business model. They have lower costs. They don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. They have no high-paid CEOs. The president is the highest-paid person, and he makes about $260,000 a year compared to the president of Wells Fargo, for example, who makes $20 million a year. So that's a big drain on their profits. No private shareholders who are taking dividends. The dividends all go back to the state. They don't need to advertise because they have this giant captive deposit base. 97% of their deposits are from the state itself. And they don't advertise for borrowers either. Their model is that they partner with the local bank. So the local bank is like, kind of like the front office where they go out and find the loans, they take in the deposits, deal with the customers. And then the Bank of North Dakota is a sort of a wholesale bank which comes in and buys down the loan, helps with capitalization. Basically, they guarantee the loan so they don't need capital. Helps with liquidity. So they allow the local banks to make much larger loans than they would have been able to otherwise. So these are loans that either would have had to go to a Wall Street bank or that just wouldn't have gotten made at all, like big development, local developments, etc. They don't speculate. They have, by right in their charter, they have a mandate to serve the public. So everything they do has to be in the public interest. They don't have branches. They just have the one office in the state capitol. They're not really catering to individuals, but they figured, well, we're a public bank. We should probably make it available to individuals. But they don't make it easy. There are no ATMs. And lest that would seem to be a unique example, we also have the example of the German savings banks, the Sparkassen, which have been around for 200 years. And they, too, came out with a report in January 2015 showing that they were more profitable than the commercial banks. That would include Deutsche Bank and the other big commercial banks in Germany. The Sparkassen have 40% of the market by assets, so they're quite big. They had a number of charts in this report, but here's one of the charts that showed that Sparkassen are the orange. So you can see they've done stellarly well since the collapse. Before the credit crisis, the baby blue or the commercial banks, they were doing fine, and then they totally crashed, and now they're barely squeezing by. The green are the credit unions, so they're also doing quite well. But so the Spark has a model like the Bank of North Dakota model is just more efficient. It used to be that public banks were sort of the black sheep of the banking industry, but every time there's a crisis, people flood back to the public banks because they're safer, for one thing. So in 1997-98, they sort of saved the day in India and other countries, and in 2008-2009, they saved the day. So there have been some recent studies showing that public banks are safer, they're less corrupt, contrary to popular belief, more efficient and more profitable. They're better for local governments and better for local economies. So one reason they're good for the economy is that they lend countercyclically. You can tell that from this chart. The blue is, these are Latin American countries with strong banking, public banking sectors. The baby blue is the lending of the public banks during the crisis from December 2008 to September 2009. And then the orange or yellow is the private banks. So the private banks were pulling in their loan, pulling in their lending, and the public banks were filling the gap by making yet more loans. If you are a state and you borrow from yourself, from your own bank, you can also save 50% on the cost of infrastructure, because 50% of the cost of infrastructure is financing. So, for example, these are just two examples from California, where I'm from. They recently redid the Bay Bridge. They did a whole section of it. And it was supposed to be $6 billion, but by the time you add in interest, it'll be $12 billion. So had they funded that through their own state-owned bank, which I'm working on with them, they could have saved the $6 billion. The bullet train is the same, California bullet train. They haven't done it yet. I mean, they've just started on it, so they've got a the voters approved a $10 billion initial outlay, and by the time you factor in interest, it'll be another nearly $10 billion. Then there's the issue of corruption. Everybody says you don't want to give the government a bank because the politicians will use it for their cronies, et cetera. You know, they'll misuse it. But this can be avoided, as is seen with the Bank of North Dakota and with the Sparkasm banks. I just did a presentation in Iceland with a man from Germany from the Sparkasm Bank, and he said it's not that we're more ethical than the other bankers. We're not more moral. He said we just have rules. It's in their charter. They can only do certain things. So they don't gamble. No speculation. No bonuses, fees, commissions, and they are fully accountable to the community that owns them. And it seems to me that today we can do something that we never could do before, which is have 100% transparency. Like, you could put all your books up on the internet and for everyone to see and avoid any sort of, I mean, corruption could be seen. And if it's in violation of a rule, you sue them or you get rid of those people and put honest people in. So that's all I've got. If you want more information, you can go to our website at publicbankinginstitute.org, or my own blog is ellenbrown.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ellen. Well, I'd like to explore a couple of points that you raised in the presentation before we'll open up to the audience for their questions. I was very struck by your historical example of Pennsylvania, and if you were to say to a politician now, here is a way in which you can levy no taxes, have no government debt, no inflation, and fund all of your government expenditure, I think they'd bite your hand off. So I'm quite interested as to your conversations in California with state officials there. How much interest actually is there in the idea of a public bank?
In California, right after we formed the Public Banking Institute, a bill passed both houses of the legislature for a feasibility study for a state-owned bank. It was all the Democrats voted for it, and all the Republicans voted against it, but it happened to be a Democratic legislature, so it passed. But Jerry Brown, who is also the governor, who is also a Democrat, didn't sign it. But now, then I ran for state treasurer, no chance of winning, 34 million people, but I did get 280,000 votes, which was more people than I know, so I guess it was worth something. And it got me an introduction to the treasurer, the actual treasurer, who was then the controller, John Chung. And so we've met with him several times. So he said something to the effect, well, if you can... you know, if you could show, they want a business model or a business plan. If you could show me a way that I, you know, I won't, we don't want to put up any money and we don't want to take any risk, but then we'll do it. But so I have a proposal, a way that they could do that. Let's say, first, they already have an iBank, an infrastructure bank. So this is a revolving fund where they have a certain pool of money. And they lend that out, and then it comes back, and they lend it out, and it comes back. So you only use it once. If you take that money and you make it the capital of your bank, you can lend it out 10 times. Well, hold back 10% for your reserves. And so you can lend out 9 times what you could have lent out as a revolving fund. And the reason that the state is in a particularly good position to do this is that they have a huge amount of deposits sitting in Wall Street that all they have to do is just move the deposits into their own banks. So that's the liquidity for this multiple sort of loan. But even if you didn't start with money that you already had, you know, this pot of money, you could borrow the money. So here was my model. Say you take $20 million is the minimum to start a bank in California. So let's say that you just do a pilot project for $20 million and you issue a bond issue at 3% for your $20 million. Then you pull $200 million of your own deposits out of J.P. Morgan or wherever they are and put it in your own local bank, your own state-owned bank. Now you can lend and hold back 10% for reserves. You can lend $180 million at 3%. You don't have to go out and even find borrowers. You can just buy bonds, buy 3% bonds with your $180 million. So you take your $180 million minus the $20 million times 3%. You've just made $160 million times 3%. No risk, no work, just one guy sitting in an office shuffling numbers around. So, of course, his response was, well, you know, the state's not allowed to buy municipal bonds. So that's the thing. We're at the stage where we need some experts. But you know, that's the general principle. You know, if you're not buying your own municipal bonds, buy something else at 3%. So that's how you leverage your money.
Well, we'll perhaps come to the how possible this is in legal terms in a moment. But California is the largest U.S. state in terms of the size of the economy, and it would be the eighth largest economy in the world if it was independent. North Dakota is quite a small state, though, isn't it? And I wanted to contextualize this for the audience, actually. I don't know if you know what the population of North Dakota is.
It's about 670,000.
670,000?
Yeah, virtually 30 million.
So I happen to come from Devon, and I can tell you that Devon has a larger population than the state of North Dakota. So this is as if Devon had a bank that made $40 million a year for Devon County Council. So I'll leave you with that thought, particularly anybody from Devon. But in terms of other states, though, so North Dakota model has attracted a lot of attention. You showed the Wall Street Journal commending its profitability. I'm interested, and you're speaking to California. Any other interest from other U.S. states, do you think, in pursuing this model?
We had 20 states that introduced bills of one sort or another, but none of them have passed. So we're at the stage where, you know, there's a lot of interest, but politicians are very conservative, and so they don't really want to rock the boat until they know they have a big constituency behind them and a business model and all the facts lined up. So that's the stage we're at where we're trying to gather a team of experts so that we can line all that up.
Well, I've got one more question before we'll come to the audience, and it's about that constituency and who might demand a bank like this, let's say. And I just wanted to mention, I know you've done a lot of work looking into this question of bail-ins. So this is a little bit technical, but what happened in Cyprus was that depositors, so ordinary people and businesses with deposits in the banks, had lost some of their deposits in order to bail out the bank, right? And my understanding of what you say about the US legislation, the Dodd-Frank, is that in the future, if a US bank gets into trouble, the way that legislation is drafted is that anything that it owes to Wall Street investment banks that it's trading with, it will have to repay those first, and ordinary public with depositors might actually lose some of their savings in the bank. they would lose money before the Wall Street banks. Is that my understanding is correct?
Yeah. Well, derivatives come first in a bankruptcy. Ever since in the U.S., in the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives, basically, they're not even in the bankruptcy. Like, they're not subject to the automatic stay, et cetera. This is in their contracts that they only enter into these derivatives on the condition that should there be a bankruptcy, they get to grab their money first. And the Bankruptcy Reform Act upholds that. I mean, I guess now they are supposed to be subject to an automatic stay of a day or so, but that's not very much. It's not long enough for the bankruptcy judge to work out the whole deal. So, for example, J.P. Morgan Chase has over $1 trillion in deposits, and the FDIC fund has $67 billion in it. So, and the derivatives of J.P. Morgan Chase, I think, they used to be $74 trillion. It might have been, they've sort of downsized a bit, like they might be in the $60 trillions now. So there's way more derivatives than there are deposits. So that whole pool that they're allowed to gamble with, that's going to be gone. It's a question of whether you can get it from the FDIC, which the FDIC isn't going to have it either. They don't have $1 trillion to cover their deposits, but they can borrow $500 billion from the Treasury. But then who's going to pay that back? I mean, it's just a very messy thing. So I was researching whether that's also true in Europe, and it appears that it is, that there are just these rules that apply to derivatives, and they always go first in a bankruptcy. It's just the way they're set up.
So it would be interesting to see the first time that happened where a bank was in trouble and it was clear that the derivatives that it owed on ranked above ordinary depositors. That would be interesting to see how that changed public perception. Now, I should emphasize, in case the Bank of England is listening, I'm not encouraging you all to withdraw your money as soon as you leave at 2 o'clock. Let's not start a bank run. But let's have some questions from the audience, please.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Anita Punwani. What role do we have as savers and borrowers in terms of where we put our deposits, the type of banks, the types of interest we demand, and also in terms of borrowing, taking out loans that we have no prospect of paying back?
Okay. Are you going to take out a loan that you can't pay back?
And the gentleman here? So we'll take a group of three questions and
I know you went to great lengths to suggest it wasn't a socialist or, dare one say, a communist principle. But as a distant observer, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, and you mentioned them both, about voting or not voting or whatever in California in favour of the idea, surely the most receptive place for this would be just north of the border, in the one place that constantly disproves any American approach, which is Canada. So I would have thought that a concept like this would resonate brilliantly with the Canadians, because they would see it, because their politics does tend to be anyway to the right of where the Democrats and the Republicans are.
Henry Ford. Two questions. In the title, why should we own the banks? Who are we? Is it you and I? Is it the state? Is it pension funds? Is it private investors? And which are the banks? Are you talking about owning J.P. Morgan, or I'm certainly confused about that.
And okay, sir.
I don't understand the overall model, which is, are you just suggesting state banks to handle the state's finances? If so, who's going to do the cross-border hedging and derivatives and so forth, which is clearly necessary in today's globalized economy?
Well, for your own account, probably in the U.S., at least, probably credit unions and your small local banks are the safest thing. But they are actually under attack as well. That was the reason this Sparkassen man came to Iceland. They're sending representatives out all over to educate people, because they are actually afraid that they're getting killed by the EU regulations, as if it appears to be intentional, and there appears to be an intentional drive to kill the local banks in the U.S. as well, or to make them merge into the big banks. But what I'm particularly writing about and particularly interested in is what the government should do with their money. For example, in California, we have $60 billion managed by the Treasurer's investment pool, currently invested at 0.3% interest, like making almost no money. They have this huge deposit base that they could be using. They're giving all that leverage away to Wall Street that we, the people of California, could be using to generate all that infrastructure. We need $700 billion worth of infrastructure over the next decade. We have a great need for money. And so my argument, or the thing that really interests me, is that we could solve all our problems by issuing money the way they did in Pennsylvania. And then we now have data, particularly from the Bank of England or Bank of Canada, 1935 to 1975, that this would not be inflationary, because they actually did that, where they borrowed from their own central bank interest-free and generated all sorts of infrastructure, set up their great healthcare system and so forth, and it was not inflationary. It was very stimulating to the economy. The economy needs more money. It's short of money right now, and the most direct way to get it out there is with some sort of public banking engine that issues it.
So if I can push you on this gentleman's question, are you suggesting that states should make use of the state's own deposits in the way that North Dakota does, to benefit the state economy, but then you would also still have Wall Street banks that would conduct international global business and investment banking alongside that?
Well, being practical and realistic, I think that they're fine the way they are, but when the next time they go bankrupt, our choices are bail them out with taxpayer money. We saw what that did. Billions or trillions of dollars worth of real estate went bad. I mean, we've got many homeless. People are out of work. The economy is not in good shape, or at least not for the lower 80% of the people. Or we can have bail-ins, where they're going to actually take our deposits. I just wrote an article about a pensioner who in Italy who hanged himself because he had lost his 100,000 euros in a bail-in. And he left a suicide note blaming the bank. I mean, we could be seeing that in the U.S. So it just seems to me that the better solution is to own the bank just ourselves, and less risky and more profitable.
Right. Well, let's take some more questions. And just on the Canada point, I think you in effect, you're right, because they did have that model earlier, but since 75, they haven't pursued it as much. So it'd be interesting to see whether they might come back to that. Now, more questions, please. There's a gentleman on the right here.
Alec Robertson, a fellow. Slightly off topic, have you a comment on Bitcoin and gold in this picture of where it might have a role?
Well, the digital currency idea and that whole the technology they're using for it is very interesting. Mm-hmm. There are a number of people, my daughter's one of them, working on trying to develop a system where you could have a global system that's essentially free of government and free of the big banks, that, you know, it should just be like a global community currency system, which would be based on the Bitcoin algorithm. Then in Ecuador, I thought they had a really interesting twist on it. They actually use the U.S. dollar, so they have to get in boatloads of dollars just to do trade. So that the government of Ecuador has started doing digital dollars. So they say they're just doing it for liquidity purposes, but obviously there's the potential there to just be issuing the money in the form of digital dollars. And then the people are using their telephones, so doing all these trades among themselves digitally. So that too is like Bitcoin, but they've actually outlawed Bitcoin as a competing currency, I guess.
And then there was a question.
I mean, I'm assuming that the bank, say, in North Dakota, would function in the way that normal banks would function in lending money to people who are developing businesses or running businesses. And I'm just interested in the monitoring of those loans. There's an army of people who decides on rescheduling the loans, calling in the loans, taking bankruptcy proceedings and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Bank of North Dakota is actually the local bank in North Dakota. I mean, you could follow their model, you could follow the Sparkasm model. There are various ways to set up your public bank. But in North Dakota, it's actually the local bank that follows the loan. And the Bank of North Dakota just helps with liquidity, helps with capitalization. But the local bank, they didn't securitize, so they didn't get into all the problems that the other states did, where they sold off their loans. And the reason they didn't have to securitize their loans, sell them off to investors, was they had the backing of the Bank of North Dakota. So the little local bank was able to, it's like old-fashioned banking where they know the people in their community, and if they were having trouble paying the loan back, they would work with them, and they had a personal interest in seeing that this loan got paid. So they were like partners instead of being this cold sort of Wall Street, you know, machine that just...
So actually, I think that point's worth just drawing out, actually, because when we're talking about the small local banks in North Dakota, these are privately owned.
Yeah.
So these are the small community. Often they can be the same family that founded them many generations on still running the bank. I mean, we don't have this in the UK, of course. So the public bank works to support, actually, the local private banks. Mm-hmm. And that's just not a model that we've seen here, but... It's interesting how they can coexist. There's a lady on the edge there.
Hi, my name's Monica Threlfall. Actually, in part, you sort of addressed my question, which is what are these local banks? So if they are private, I mean, how would... I don't quite understand how this that would... I mean, I think your talk's wonderful, and I want to start my own bank tomorrow. Yeah, that's where I'm coming from. But
yeah.
In the British context, I mean, how could we live without cash machines or ATMs? As you call them, ATMs. How would that work? And would we just have to use our same old, you know, Lloyds, Barclays, etc., at the same time? I'm being really micro-practical, but I'm presuming if anybody did start a bank in Britain, it would be successful, a public bank. So how would it relate to the existing banks?
I like the fact that you're trying to work out how to do it. This is good. This is good. So, and then there were two more questions we were going to take. A gentleman in the middle.
Hi, I'm a treasurer of a local credit union, and I was really intrigued by the performance of the credit unions in Germany and in line with Sparkasse, and I'd be really intrigued to understand the relationship between the credit unions in Germany and Sparkasse in maintaining, you know, the funding and liquidity in the market. And also I'd be really intrigued if you have any observations as to why you think credit unions in the UK struggle so for awareness and for take-up.
Thank you very much. Hello, Justin Walker. About 6-7 years ago, I read your excellent article on the Bank for International Settlements, and I managed to get an interview with my MP last year, and he'd been an MP, I won't name him, it's not fair, but he'd been an MP for 9 years and had never heard of the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central bank for all central banks. What level of ignorance do you think there is in governance overall about the central banking system and how basically money is created?
A leading question, Your Honour. But a good question, and so we will come to that. So take us through again how the local banks work with, in terms of cash points and other services, with the public bank.
Mm-hmm. Well, that in North Dakota, they actually have more local banks than any other state per capita. The local banks love the Bank of North Dakota. The Bankers Association affirms that, or you know, endorses them. As for setting up your own bank, I mean, you're going to need a publicly owned. Your own bank would be private, and then you're going to need a publicly owned bank if you're going to follow that model. So I don't know. It could be a county owned bank or a city owned bank. The Sparkasse are actually not owned by anybody, and that's one reason they've managed to survive. They're like we have 501c3s in the U.S. I don't know what you would call them here, but things that are, they don't have stock, and they're public interest entities. So there was, for example, a city that tried to sell off some private bank wanted to buy their Sparkasse, or Sparkasse, however you say it. My German's not so good. Somebody wanted to buy it, and then the Sparkasse Bank themselves said, nope, legally, the city doesn't own us, so you can't sell us. But then that's just their model. And there are other countries, you know, that are all the, like China, virtually all the 80% of the banks are publicly owned. And so I guess you would work out your own model. But I would think in England, the ideal thing would be, for example, maybe take RBS. I saw a very good...
Yeah, I wrote that one, yeah. Thank you very much.
Tony wrote a very good article about how the RBS can be turned into a... But you want to talk about that?
Well, I think we can come to the question on credit unions. I'm not doing the talk. So we'll come to the credit unions question, though, because, you know, if we don't have this rich fabric of
local community privately owned banks, which the US does, and neither do we have the Sparkassen, which Germany does. Indeed, we have trustee savings banks and so on. But this gentleman was asking about credit unions, and maybe could credit unions play the same role? And I don't know whether you have any observations from the fact that you do travel to, you know, internationally, about why, or any observations about the British credit union movement, why it's so small compared to other places. But
I don't know the British credit unions, but I know in the U.S. that the credit union's a very safe place to keep your money, and it's a good deal for the members, but it is privately owned by the members, and there's so many restrictions on what they can do. They just can't make big loans, and they're not owned by... What I write about and what I'm particularly interested about in is governments, because they have so much power that they're giving away, so much money that they're giving away. They're giving away that potential to these big banks to speculate with when they could be using that themselves.
Well, I know that a lot of local authorities are very supportive of credit unions, and maybe if we did see local authority banks in the UK, that would also stimulate the credit union movement. I mean, it's an interesting thought. So, which brings us to the question of the extent of ignorance of politicians. And please do comment on our own, but perhaps you're more familiar with the US ones. But how much of it is a problem, actually, that policymakers don't know that much about how banks work?
I think it's a huge problem. Our politicians are, I heard somebody say that U.S. politicians are all lawyers, and so they all argue with each other. And Chinese politicians are engineers, and they want to get out there and build something.
Right.
You know, it'd be so. And also in the Chinese system, you have no parties, so they're competing on the basis of skills. And so they're in politics for 40 years before they make it to the top, whereas we elect people, you know, wives of wealthy people or people that are just not, no offense to my own sex, but just not real sophisticated in the issues and very easily manipulated by lobbyists and by big money. So I think it's a huge problem in the U.S. that politicians don't know a lot of things that they should be more savvy to.
Well, you mentioned in your talk the fact that the banks actually create the money supply. And that's true in the US, it's true in the UK. So the money supply that we all use are bank deposits, and these are created by banks when they lend. Now, I believe that there was a poll, and I can see the person who commissioned it in the audience, so he'll correct me, that 1 in 10 MPs were aware of this. Is that right?
Yeah,
Ben? So only 1 in 10 members of Parliament understand actually how money is created and therefore how banks work. Now, I thought that was surprisingly high. and it is an advance on a few years ago. But I think your question is well put, because and perhaps it relates back to an earlier question about our responsibility also as individuals that save and borrow, that getting to know more about how banks work and therefore what alternatives might be and pressing for change is perhaps quite important. But I don't know why I'm talking. Let's have more questions.
You mentioned China, second largest economy now, 80% publicly banked, as it were. We're concerned about that economy right now. What observations would you make on the Chinese public banking system, and should we be concerned about risks within that?
We'll take that question then. So surely we can't let you get away with holding up the Chinese banking system as a good model.
I actually think, well, I heard this China. I read of this Chinese economist, a woman. When the Chinese succumbed to the World Trade Organization rules, and she said, "Well, if they want us to call them non-performing loans, we'll call them non-performing loans. But we're going to continue. We're not going to change our practices." So what they did originally was they just issued the money for whatever they needed, and they were just keeping track of some things got paid back and some things didn't. Some things were profitable and some things weren't. But overall, they managed to do their mandate and support the economy, et cetera. So their public banks now look like they have a lot of bad loans on them, but it doesn't matter because they create the money and they can write off those loans. And even their stock market is not nearly as big as in the U.S., and it is just a big casino, and so people lose money in it, but it's not crashing their economy. And even the fact that they've built all these empty apartments and buildings. I mean, they did put people to work. It's sort of that thing of you can dig tunnel, or what was it, dig something and holes and fill them back up, that Keynes said.
I think that's Keynes suggested, yeah. Yeah. You can set people to work by burying money and getting them to dig it
you're
up.
You're creating jobs, putting the people to work. Yeah. And I think they actually believe that people will come and fill those at some point. So they did make a mistake in where they allocated their credit. But the model itself is not all that bad. The Chinese or the Japanese, from after World War II, continued this sort of war economy, although they were not at war. But what they did was it was centrally controlled, and it was called window guidance, where they told the banks what to lend for. And so originally they were building things that were very useful for the economy. But then at some point, Richard Werner thinks this was all manipulated, the Bank of Japan came in and sort of forced them to make loans for housing, like too big of loans, too much credit went to housing. And this was just pushed out there, and they were required to do it until their housing market exploded. And arguably, this was a ruse to bring down Japan, because everybody was afraid that the Japanese were going to come to the U.S. and buy up everything. Anyway, there are a lot of undercurrents to what's going on, but I still think that the model itself has great potential. So some countries maybe haven't used it quite right. It's all an experiment. We're all in a great big experiment.
Right. So, it's, yeah. So in a way, your answer is that it may not always be perfect, but then I guess private banks haven't exactly always had an unblemished record on lending either. There was a gentleman here.
On first hearing your talk, I was thinking very much this is a long way from the British example, North Dakota being so small. But I think there are some interesting general points that are perhaps more applicable to the UK, one of which is the misalignment between the motives of the banks and their profit motive, and the fact we need banks for the credit creation in the economy and to supply the lending. Secondly, the idea of dissociating the credit creation from the process of actually handling the loans, because the separation between the central North Dakota bank and the local banks who are doing the management of the loans creates some interesting questions about the way in which local banking and banking of individuals is handled by huge conglomerates that are actually more interested in many other parts of their business than necessarily serving individual customers. So I think there may be ways in which perhaps this could be developed, do you think, in the UK, using the principles but rather than the mechanics of the North Dakota example?
Okay. Well, I'll take that mostly as a comment. But lady next, if you've got a short question,
yeah,
that would be ideal.
So you've mentioned Cyprus and the bail-in that happened a few years ago. And I happen to actually come from Cyprus, and you're right, the consequences were horrific for people's lives. So I was wondering, what can we do as individuals, or what kind of institutions can we create to push governments to start thinking about the model that you are proposing?
So let's deal with those two, and then maybe we can wrap that into a concluding thought on what we can do to push governments and how those principles might apply, even if we don't actually set up a public bank.
Mm-hmm. Well, I totally agree that you have to shape it to your own situation. In Ireland, they have a lot of credit unions, and they have many areas that have no banks at all, unbanked areas. And so it wouldn't be hard at all to set up a Sparkasm model, and there are actually four political parties that now endorse that platform to have a system of public banks, and it wouldn't even compete with the big banks, because you're talking about a market that's currently unserved. I'm not sure about the exact British or UK, your circumstances here, but yeah, I just think the principle of publicly owned banks is good. And then on what we can do to approach our politicians, well, at the Public Banking Institute, we've been working at that for quite some time now. And at first, you know, we set up this institute. First we had a Google group, and we went round and round on all these issues, and we had some heavy hitters. We had somebody from the Federal Reserve on our Google group and some bankers, you know, and after a couple of years, we felt like we knew more than everybody else and that it was time to get out there and do something. So we formed an institute. And then we got these 20 states that had bills pending, and the bills haven't passed because we need the next stage, which is we need to come up with the experts and the popular support for a movement that is enough to push the politicians to take the radical step of changing anything. You know, they always need a constituency behind them, so...
Well, I think popular support for a movement is quite a nice place to end. We are out of time, so let me just say that we have got more. We have blogs and we have previous lectures and we have material about banking and reforming the economy on the RSA website. Don't forget to check that out. And please join me in thanking very warmly Ellen Brown for her coming.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.